We also, as the chairman mentioned, will be producing vaccine at risk, which means we'll be investigating considerable resources in developing doses even before we know any given candidate or candidate's work. I must.
Now we have two vaccines that are really quite effective. The mRNA vaccine, highly effective.
Extraordinarily efficacious, 94 to 95% for mild to moderate disease, and virtually 100% efficacious.
Because the real world effectiveness is even more impressive than the results of the clinical trial.
Clarify that with people. It has nothing to do with whether or not it's effective. We know it's highly effective. Highly effective.
Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. Thank you for joining me today. I thought that was a very appropriate thing to begin with today, which you've seen before, because we're going to be talking about booster shots today. And even in that conversation, you hear them saying, no, because there's no indication that the boosters mean it doesn't work. And we're going to kind of get into that conversation today and how we see this cycle beginning of this never-ending booster shots and how that drives us in, as you've been hearing me talk about, into the infrastructure, as well as with the natural immunity conversation. We may touch on that a little bit today. We're also going to be talking about Whitney Webb's new article for Unlimited Hangout about Moderna, which is a really important article that I'm still going through myself. And to discuss all of that, welcoming Whitney Webb to the show. How are you today?
Hey, doing well. Hey, Ryan, how's it going? Hi, everyone watching.
Always a pleasure to have you back on. I know your time is very limited today with everything that's going on in your life, so I really appreciate you taking the time to be here and talk about this, because where you are, as I understand it, you're having some insight, sort of like what we're seeing in Israel, into the future of the booster shot cycle. So first of all, how are you and how is everything going? And then let's jump into that conversation.
Well, you know, I'm okay. You can probably see behind me, my office is a little cluttered because I'm preparing to have kid number two here in another.
Uh-oh. We might have lost her. Not surprising. While it's freezing, I'm hoping we get her back.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there we go. We got you.
I was gonna look
for a minute.
There we go. Okay, sorry about that.
No worries. You said kid number two.
Anyway. So anyway, I have a bunch of stuff in the back of my office for that right now. So, you know, just a lot of busy stuff work-wise and personally. It's always busy work-wise these days, especially since COVID stuff started, because, I mean, so much to talk about, not enough people talking about it. Because of the censorship stuff and what have you. Though I'm sure people have noticed there have been some more notable shifts over the past couple weeks in that sense. Let's hope it's genuine. Remains to be seen, of course. But, you know, better late than never. Can't quite complain.
Yeah, you know, I like that you said that, because it's one thing I'm trying to, you know, I'm sure anybody that's been on this from the very beginning and watched the grudging, you know, it's hard for bigger people to step up and start talking about it and get a lot of it, you know, so it's a little frustrating, but I've been trying to pull myself back in and go, you know, we have to bridge these gaps. And if they're actually genuine in what they're doing and they are seeing it, well, that's a great thing. You know, I had Jimmy on, which it seems like he's talking about it. I talked to Ben Swan, who's been on it from the beginning. I'm going to be having Kim Iverson on shortly. She's going through the same thing, you know, different in the beginning, and she is just jamming it now. And so it's like, we need to see this happening and kind of bridge those gaps, even across party lines. Sorry, I just wanted to get that out there because I'm so passionate about that right now from everything that's going on. But
yeah, well, we've been saying this from the beginning, right, Ryan? It's all hands on deck. So, you know, if more hands come on deck later on, better late than never. I mean, obviously, you know, the fact that people like you and myself got hit with the censorship hammer for covering this stuff from the beginning, you know, it would have been nice to have had more more voices then, perhaps. You know, but it's definitely a speedier turnaround on that we're seeing among some of these individuals, you know, on this type of stuff than it has been, for example, with 9/11, right? Well, thank goodness we don't have to wait 20 years to get more hands on deck, right? So, well, you know, I can't.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting is that may bring them back. Like, that may actually open up some of these people that have been really resistant to realizing what you've been saying, right? It's just step number two, recognize number one, which was the first part, security state to biosecurity state. So hopefully they'll dive into your work and they'll connect the dots. That would be fantastic.
Yeah. But, you know, whatever we can get at this point, you know, I'll take. Things are pretty nuts. Like they are in Chile, which, honestly, doesn't get a lot of coverage because, you know, like what's going on in Australia, for example, totally insane. That tends to get a decent amount of coverage. But that's because, you know, that's an English speaking country. Independent media in Spanish language, independent media is, it doesn't really exist. there is sort of some networks, I guess you could say, that are trying to be like resistance networks, but they are like they're like QAnon style a lot of the time, and draw from sort of those networks in English and then translate that content into Spanish. There's not a lot of things challenging the narrative, and thus, you know, there's also not a lot of information coming out about what's going on in Latin America. You know, it that's not really seeping into English language independent media.
Do you think that's the only barrier? Do you think it's a language barrier, or is there something more? Because there's a lot of people make arguments, which I agree with, that there's more of a cultural thing. You know, even like, let's say Venezuela, for instance, you can see like the Guaidos of the world from a different cultural class than the people that. Go ahead. Do you have any thoughts? Sorry, it's cutting out.
Well, are you talking? Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I got you back. Go ahead.
Okay. Are you talking about within Chile? I'm talking about just like how, why so few people tend to know what has happened here, despite it being one of the more extreme countries.
I just meant in general, you know, just the South America or these, you know, different places that you're right. They seem to just get discounted or not discussed. And I wondered if you thought that was more than just the language barrier, if there's more of like a racial thing going on there in regard to foreign policy, which seems to be coming up more and more, like from Bolivia, for example.
Okay. So, you know, in terms of like Bolivia and Venezuela, Chile doesn't fit in that category, because, you know, from 1973 on, it's been very much aligned with the U.S. and the Five Eyes group, the U.S.-UK foreign policy nexus. It's never really deviated from that in any significant way since the 1973 coup. I wouldn't really put it in the same category as something like Bolivia post Evo Morales or Venezuela post Chavez, right?
So it's lockstep with the plan, with what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, what's significant about Chile, right, is that the current president, he was president before, I believe, when W. Bush was president of the U.S. roughly. And his name is Sebastian Piñera. This is his second term. Basically, Piñera frames himself as being sort of like a right wing Maybe if you ask him, he would say center-right type of politician. He's a billionaire and a real piece of crap. Basically, his big ambition leading up to COVID-19 was to have Chile be the leading smart nation of Latin America, be the first in 5G, the Latin American leader of the fourth industrial revolution. He, in his sort of like the Chilean equivalent of the State of the Union address in 2019, promoted this stuff nonstop and was like, we're going to be the first, blah, blah, blah. Things like that. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know, for example, that we since COVID-19, we've had, you know, statements from the World Economic Forum and things like that, that the vaccination campaign, the vaccine passports are fundamental to the fourth industrial revolution. I'm sure you've covered that on your show. Mm-hmm. So it's not really surprising that you would have that follow. But really, I think the way that Chile has, the Piñera administration has handled the COVID-19 situation is very much in line with what groups like the World Economic Forum ideally would have liked to have seen the world over, but didn't necessarily. So just some background, though, on the vaccination campaign situation in Chile right now, you have about 90% of all adults having taken both doses. Okay, you have, I think, 5 million out of 5 million people having taken the third dose. Chile's total population is roughly around 18 million, so a lot of people. They've essentially mandated the third dose for everyone over 55, but I think I saw a story today that it will be for everyone, like I predicted on Twitter the other day. You know, once they make it mandatory for a certain segment of society and they announce they're going to do a fourth dose, they're obviously going to mandate the third dose for everyone. So the vaccine passport in Chile, which is called the mobility pass, the pase de movilidad, it is now mandatory for people 12 and up.
Wow.
So roughly 90% of people between 12 and 17 have had at least one dose, and I believe it's about 70% have had both. So Chile is far and ahead of, I think, almost other countries in terms of the vaccination of adolescents. I think it was in September, they started going school to school around the country to vaccinate ages 6 and up, which is something that was recently, of course, just in the past couple of days, approved in the U.S., 5 to 11, right? Well, Chile did that. 6 to 11 previously, but went about going school to school vaccinate children. Allegedly, parents, parental consent was required, but obviously there are some cases where it appears to have not been at the top-down level of the Ministry of Health or Ministry of Education that this happened, based on sort of administrative decisions at particular schools, but some parents were not informed. And we're seeing that this also apparently happened in the U.S., has happened in the U.S. in some cases, though, with a slightly higher age group, and that some parents are suing because of that. Basically, the plan is now to, lower that requirement for the vaccine passport to 6 years of age at some point in the future. And they've signaled that what the mobility pass is currently required for is going to expand very shortly. Piñera said just a few days ago, every day that goes by, we will make life harder and harder for the unvaccinated. It's essentially a direct quote. And they've been going very hard, the Ministry of Health people, over on the news the past couple of days about this is the pandemic of the unvaccinated narrative.
Right.
And things like that, despite the fact that actually there have been, there is a transparency law here that's sort of like Freedom of Information Act requests. And there has been evidence that, in fact, that's not the case. So you can even prove that beyond the case studies in other countries, in Chile as well. But here it's a total echo chamber in terms of media. The mainstream media has been in total lockstep with really not just with COVID-19, but really with everything, in the past year and a half, 2 years, more or less. You don't have any sort of diversity in opinion that would normally define a free press. But if you ask Chileans, do we have a free press here? I'm sure they would tell you yes.
Isn't it funny how all the vassal states of the U.S. out there, the U.S. government, are all the opposite of what they're trying to say they're trying to build everywhere? It's just that's a good example of what they're actually doing. But I want to ask you about coercion. It's obvious there's coercion happening. I mean, mandates are coercion in and of themselves. But in your opinion, in Chile, and I know you've only been there back for a little while now, do you see a lot of pushback, or does it seem the populace is sort of just like going along with it because of the media manipulation?
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of pushback here. But there is a segment of the population large enough that has clearly pissed off the government that won't get vaccinated. And it's really not that big. Like I mentioned earlier, it's like the population of Chile is like 18 million. It's really not. I mean, if you're familiar with Chile on a map, maybe you're not. I don't know. It's a long, skinny country on the Pacific coast of Latin America. It's not necessarily like the largest country there, it does have a lot of resources and stuff, which makes it, I guess, economically important. But in terms of population size, it's nothing like Brazil or anything like that. Sorry, I got sidetracked talking about.
No, no worries. That's actually the perfect segue into my next question was, so we've seen a lot of things like Belarus is the best example where he came out and just called it out. The IMF's trying to give me almost $1 billion to do all
that. Oh, the IMF doesn't need to bribe Piñera to go along with this. No. Okay. Well, oh, sorry. I remembered my point before. Yeah. So basically the amount of unvaccinated, they came out on the TV. This was probably like a week ago. And they said, we have a database of everyone in the country based on your national ID number, the DNI or the root, RUT. And we know everyone that's gotten the vaccine and that who hasn't, right? And they were saying 1.2 million people haven't been vaccinated. And they are basically announced that soon they may pressure them to get it in a door-to-door type of scenario. And then, of course, you had a good little obedient reporter from one of the corporate channels say something like, are you going to make it mandatory for everyone to have this? And they were like, well, we're keeping all options on the table and, they won't rule it out.
Right.
Things like that. And they've already signaled they're going to make life as hard as possible. It's currently, the vaccine passport, if you want to leave the region of Chile you live in, which I guess sort of on the U.S. scale would be sort of something slightly larger than a county. you kind of have to, you have to have a vaccine passport at this point, and you can't leave the country without one. Only in the cases that are deemed exceptional cases. And that, of course, whether or not your reason for travel is valid is determined by the national police. They determine if you're allowed to leave the country or not. I can't really leave unless I can justify that somehow, for example.
The subjective nature of all this seems to be one of the parts that keeps standing out to me. That, for instance, I'm going to be interviewing a nurse that is, a Christian, and she claimed that in her religious exemption. And they say, we don't believe that you actually feel that way. I can't even believe we're in a point where that's happening in any sense, where the government's going, yeah, we don't agree that you have it. They call it a sincerely held belief. It's just showing you that it's really just an illusion of having a choice, that they go, yeah, fill that paper out and we'll just say no anyway. It's pretty frustrating.
Well, like, here's the thing. They didn't even need to do the vaccine mandate stuff here in Chile to get 90%. People were just like, oh yeah, okay. We love obeying the state here because we're all scared because the TV has scared us. So, it's nuts. I mean, even here you have a mask mandate technically. It's, you're legally required to wear a mask in any public space, including outside, walking down the street, whatever, and in any store and whatever. Where I live, police don't really enforce the outside one anymore. So, I can get around it, and I'm pregnant. And so conveniently here, I can be like, oh, look at my baby bump. And they they leave me alone. Right. But that doesn't really happen on you know, most people are very happy to wear it. People are actually very excited in some cases. I've seen on several occasions to show their mobility pass to get special privileges. They're like, look what a good citizen I have been.
Mobility.
Let me show you. Well, it's funny because the mobility pass doesn't really give you as many rights as you think. And if the state decides that you have not complied with other sanitary norms, they can just block it, even if you've had all the doses.
Wow.
They've done that in several cases.
It's so subjective, and it really does show you that health is not the focal point, which brings us kind of to the idea of that control around the booster. Like, if they can just kind of subjectively go, yeah, you've had two doses, but we don't like this thing, so we're still not going to count it. It just shows you that the booster step is obviously what's happening here. And we're seeing it in Israel. We're seeing it already sort of begin in the U.S., where you won't be considered fully vaccinated for your passport system if you don't have the next one.
And Chile has even gone beyond saying, oh, we're doing a fourth dose. They've gone to say, actually, this is going to be at least yearly. They said that a couple of days ago. And we knew that, right? People like you and myself were covering that last year. I know that in my report on the AstraZeneca vaccine developers last December, I mentioned that as early as I think April or May of 2020, these guys were saying this is going to be an annual vaccine. So anyone that's surprised by that, by the whole booster thing, and was blindsided by that. I mean, they've been telling you if you were paying attention.
Exactly what we keep saying, right? Well, what I think is kind of happening, at least in Chile, and specifically Chile, like you're saying, they didn't need to do it. They were already on board. It's a pilot program, right? I mean, Israel's doing the same thing, where we already see them telling people it's going to be the cycle, yet the media pretends like that's not the case. So before we jump into the booster, what I think is interesting is you're talking about a place that's been lockstep in this plan, mask mandates everywhere, injections through the mat, but look at the breakdown, right? I mean, and these are just reported, so we have to question these as well. But here's your rising deaths from May old and continuing, and here's the cases. So it's just amazing. We're in a position where we see it literally not working based on what they tell you should be working with the vast majority of the population, and we're just going to the next injection. Like, you know, what are your thoughts on that? Mass psychosis? Well, I mean, what are we talking about here?
Well, essentially what they're doing now is they're blaming this rise in cases on the unvaccinated, right?
Exactly.
In order to make it even harder for people that aren't vaccinated, at least increase the social pressure and things like that. It's been interesting to see, to say the least, because they do stress, you know, if you talk to one of the health people or a functionary from the Ministry of Health, they'll be like, well, it is voluntary, right? But, you know, it's getting to the point where they're probably going to try and twist the screws as much as possible. What's interesting, though, is that not only did they basically come out and say, like, oh, we know where you live, unvaccinated people, we know how many of you there are and what your name is and all this stuff and your address and blah, blah, blah. But in a couple days, it went from 1.2 million to 1.6 million. So I think they may be lying about the amount of people of concern and enough for them to address it and fearmonger about it that extensively. It remains to be seen. One thing that does need to be noted is that the vaccines available in Chile are slightly different than those of the U.S. One of the main vaccines here is the Sinovac one, the Chinese one, CoronaVac. And actually, Chile was one of the main experimental, real-world experiment case studies for Sinovac specifically. I think Brazil was actually the other one as well, but a focus on Latin America, probably because people in Africa are tired of being guinea pigs. Well, their amount of the amount of vaccines they're taking when it's available, you know, has been much lower than was anticipated by groups like COVAX. Some of these other ones. So they're clearly not as on board as some of the people in Latin America seem to be. And I think, I don't know if you covered this or not, Ryan, but Pfizer essentially announced a whole Brazilian city is going to be part of their their study. Not that people really get to consent or not. We'll see how that goes.
Right. Well, I don't know if you saw there's a recent coverage been going on around, I was going to maybe discuss this in the next show. There's a good breakdown from an Indian mainstream channel discussing the Pfizer contracts and how really weird and deep and how undiscussed they are. Right. And so maybe, I mean, that seems like an example. Brazil was one of the focal points where they're not allowed to discuss what's going on within it, that if they end up defaulting, they end up give up their own state assets. I mean, and since we brought it up, I want your thoughts on this. It struck me as a really interesting thought that you and I have discussed in regard to the NGOs, Natural Endowment for Democracy. Of course, I remember them now. I forgot it while I was on the show. Or USAID being used as Trojan horses, as Corbett has covered. And so now the way Pfizer's acting, you know, the public-private crossover, they're filling a role that almost seems like they're becoming the new Trojan horse of whatever government backing is behind them and asking for state assets and control or laws not applying to the way they conduct themselves. What are your thoughts?
Pfizer is basically doing what the IMF normally does. Isn't that kind of weird? Yeah, it's not good. But I think it's showing that the role of the IMF doesn't necessarily like have to be performed by them anymore. They can just, come out in the open and show who's really pulling a lot of the strings here, which more often than not have to be tend to be very powerful multinational corporations or central banking institutions, things like that tend to be the ones most in. But now we're seeing, you know, multinational corporations sort of come out and fulfill that role of sort of demanding, getting more involved with policy making in the state side of things. Part of this public-private partnership stuff just becoming even more ubiquitous, I guess you could say, on a global scale. Obviously not good because, as we've talked about before, you know, the whole public-private partnership thing is really no different than corporatism, fascism, Mussolini's definition of fascism. And so we're definitely, the fact that Pfizer's doing that should be very alarming to people. Among a lot of other developments in that particular realm of corporations taking control of much more than they ever should.
Do you think that that's because of the IMF kind of getting caught essentially by Belarus and others exposing that they were giving money for compliance in regard to their program? Maybe that's why they shifted to something else. I mean, what do you think?
Maybe. I don't think these people give a crap about optics anymore. I think they're far past the time for that, you know? So it's hard to know exactly. I think the fact that, because the whole vaccination campaign has sort of been publicly cloaked in this, as altruistic and things like that, it may have been easier for them to sneak that stuff in the contracts because no one was really going to look there, right? Oh, we need the vaccine. There's this urgency. There's this desperation that has been whipped up among the public. So they're not going to be looking into the nitty gritty of those types of, you know, fine print documents, right? So I think that's more likely why that happened.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, before we shift over to your article, I wanted to finish off with the booster. So give us what you're seeing and really give a deep, you know, from what you see already, what you've researched in regard to how this seems to be laid out for these people, especially for Americans right now that are questioning whether or not that process is already a given. I mean, we're seeing it happening in Israel already, but what's happening in Chile? So they're going to have a third dose, a fourth dose, and how is that laid out and how long does it seem to be laid out for?
Okay, so it's about like every 6 months, like 6 months after the last dose, you have to get a new dose. So it's probably going to be semi-annual, the way it's developing in Chile right now. But they're saying annual, right? Mm-hmm. But it seems like it's set up based on how they've created this situation with the third dose that it's going to be 6 months, because this one is, you know, the third dose 6 months after your second dose. So we can assume the fourth dose will be similar, and they've already bought the supply for the fourth dose. So because of expiration dates, it can't exactly be, you know, a year from now, probably not anyway. So it's most likely a semi-annual affair. And that is, you know, if you look at the market analysts, what they anticipate the stock sales of companies like Moderna and Pfizer to be for next year. A couple months ago, even when the booster dose stuff was in the cards, it was anticipated Moderna, for example, in 2022, next year, would make like $1 billion in COVID-19 vaccine sales. That has since soared because of how things have developed. To $35 billion next year. That's a massive increase, isn't it? That implies that it's definitely going to be, the push will be for semi-annual, not annual. Yeah. Because that's an insane figure. beyond that, you know, why is it so? Basically, in Chile, it's an app on your phone. It's a QR code, right? And this is sort of happening in a very patchwork system in the United States. There, in my opinion, in the U.S., there will be a push eventually to make a federal system, a unified, standardized system that will also be digital. Because really, what this is about, you know, we argue about, like, you know, what the anticipated or intended the effects of the vaccine to be on terms of public health and whatever, you know, that's one issue. But the other issue is that this is the reason the World Economic Forum, for example, views the vaccination campaign as fundamental to the fourth industrial revolution is because the vaccine passport is the first step towards the digital ID, as described by ID 2020, which is a combination of a biometric ID to access government and private services or corporate services, I guess you could say, along with your wallet for digital currencies that are approved. Presumably that will only be CBDCs because no one's going to use those if there's any competition. And in my opinion, they have to eliminate competition entirely in order to force mass adoption of that because they're so unattractive compared to, you know, crypto and things like that. And then, of course, your electronic health records, which is where the vaccination status comes in. It's vaccination status for now, but eventually all your stuff will be tied to that. That's already happened to some extent with the UK NHS produced equivalent of the vaccine passport. With Chile, it's not that extensive yet, but really Chile has been much farther ahead for years in terms of the biometric ID thing. Even kids as young as 5, when they have to get a state ID, have to be fingerprinted here.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a you can thank Piñera for that also. So that's the kind of agenda this guy's been pursuing. It's no coincidence that he was put in power for this particular event to advance these agendas. What's interesting in Chile is that the candidate that was going to basically be Piñera 2.0, his last name is Michel, and frequently talked about the fourth industrial revolution and other things in his campaign, did not succeed like he was supposed to. Instead, the further to the right, anti-globalist, more Trumpian style candidate is actually at the top of the polls. And he is the only one that actually opposes any sort of expansion or mandatory use of the vaccine passport system in quarantines. I don't know. We'll see what happens there. I'm not necessarily a that guy. A lot of people accuse him of being fascist. He's the son of a Chicago boy, if you're familiar with who those are from the Pinochet era. But honestly, what could be more fascist than what Piñera is currently doing? It is kind of, you know, rock between a hard place. I have mixed feelings about it. But really, in Chile at the moment, all the political options are very bad. And if there's one that's going to oppose the vaccine passport thing as someone who is not vaccinated, you know, could be worse from my perspective, obviously, but they didn't expect the Seychelles guy to lose for whatever reason. I'm not exactly sure. Well, I can make some assumptions, but it would take a long time to explain about why this other candidate, Jose Antonio Kast, is so far ahead in the polls. Compared to other people, a lot of it has to do with some of the protests from October 2019 in Chile, the Constitutional Convention and pushback from that, because it has not really been what it was advertised to be. It's kind of a mess. I don't know. There's a lot of crazy stuff happening in Chile right now, but it's possible that, you know, if Kast does is elected and does keep that promise about the vaccine passport, there may be changes to how this advances. But, you know, based on what they're signaling now, and presumably they will act to keep a candidate friendly to that agenda, be the one that ultimately comes to power. You know, this is sort of how they've set it up. But basically, it's to force you know, adoption of a QR code digital ID system in order for you to participate in society that basically has constantly changing requisites in order for it to continue to be valid. So for now, that's going to be, you know, the booster doses and whatnot, but could easily have other things tacked onto it. For example, Piñera and his administration are very much in the same same vein as like the Boris Johnson government of the UK with net zero, the net zero economy. So, you know, this whole like carbon credit, energy rationing stuff could be applied to that very easily. And it honestly wouldn't be surprising to see them do that.
I completely agree. And we've been really trying to drill that home, is that we have to see this as an infrastructure as opposed to just about injections. Clearly, it's about that and it matters. And there's something more nefarious in that, in my opinion. But as you just laid out, I mean, this is, it's easy to see this going booster, booster, booster. Oh, now it's carbon. You know, oh, wait, now you got carbon. Now you got social credit. Like, you got different things that are, you know, the block to you achieving whatever you need to achieve to be able to have access to society. And once that's built, you know, as anything else, it's not going away. And that's a really alarming reality that places like Chile and Israel are beginning to show, that you are just being strung along. And I just quickly on that unvaxxed versus vaxxed point, I've done a lot of work on that, and I hope people will dive into that further to realize that, as Whitney pointed out, in Chile, the data just does not back that up. It's very easy to look up and see based on things they're giving you. And all they keep screaming is that the unvaccinated are causing all of this, when even their studies from before show you clearly that the situation they have created, whether by intention or negligence, is what leads to making these variants, right? Exactly the way these are working. The studies are all there from before. It's amazing how COVID has just said, everything before this doesn't count anymore. Now we're recreating your society and what we understand about everything. It's quite alarming. But let's bring this over into Moderna, specifically with your article that was, and full disclosure, as I said before, I haven't got a chance to read this all the way through, but it's already interesting me based on what you guys have probably seen me talk about before. The Moderna's discussion about how they were wildly overvalued and with not really producing, in fact, failing repeatedly. And you discuss Moderna gets its miracle. So tell us about this article, Whitney.
Well, this is part two in a series that's now three parts. I was hoping to keep it two, but stumbled upon something that they've recently gotten involved with within the past month that is just unreal. So that'll be in part three. I sort of allude to it at the end of this article. But the first article I had was about how Moderna was a company desperately in need of a Hail Mary. That's a quote from a mainstream media report about, you know, former employees and companies saying, you know, basically this Moderna is the emperor's new clothes. They're really an investment firm hoping that the hype they sell stock or that they sell their company onto investors will turn into a drug that will be approved at some point, right? It's not a company that was built on something proven and then hyped after the fact. It, you know, hype preceding the scientific foundation for its technology. It's very similar in a lot of ways to Theranos, which some people may be familiar with because of the ongoing court case there. I document in part one how Stefan Bancel is just remarkably similar to Elizabeth Holmes of that company in a variety of ways. But essentially, you know, the promise of Moderna that they're going to revolutionize medicine, the same promise Theranos had made, was really all that was keeping the company afloat. As I document in this article specifically, though, you know, basically I ended that article with, you know, mid 2019 for Moderna. So essentially this one picks up at the end of 2019 through COVID to just before the emergency use authorization process with the FDA. So part three will pick up in December of 2020 and come bring us to the present, essentially. Thinking of where to, well, so basically at the end of 2019, I was actually admitted by Moderna executives on Tuesday, very convenient for the timing of the publication of this report of mine, according to Bancel and who's the CEO and also Moderna's president and some other executives, that basically Moderna had in fact reached the end of the line by the end of 2019 in terms of facing complete and imminent financial collapse at that point in time. They were, their president, direct quote from this week, "We were freaked out about the money. you know, talking about 2019, cutting back on everything, telling people not to travel, not to do this. They had entered a perilous financial situation that at the very least was going to last several years. And that's, you know, CEO executives speak to the underlings, right? So like, I was probably much more dire than even that, right? Mm-hmm. And as I lay out in part one, there's a variety of factors and circumstances that were pushing Moderna towards complete collapse, right? So, but also at the end of 2019, we have Barney Graham, head of the VRC of the National Institute for Allergies and Infectious Disease, or I guess NIAID, that Anthony Fauci heads. So Barney Graham is one of the instrumental figures at the NIH in the Moderna NIH partnership to produce what is Moderna's, or referred to as Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine. But that was technically co-developed with the National Institutes of Health, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, Barney Graham at the end of 2019, at the same time Moderna was about to collapse, was emailing the head of his coronavirus team at the NIH and saying, get ready for 2020, before anyone knew that whatever the little reports that were trickling out of China then, no one knew that was a coronavirus, right? So why did he just email the coronavirus team lead? Why not the team leads of other infectious diseases, right, perhaps. Right.
Was this in the same time frame as the, let's just say specifically, U.S. Congress members that were cashing in and making lots of money right before?
If I remember correctly, that was like February 2020,
okay,
when that happened. So this is December 2019. This is before
I misheard you. Go ahead.
This is way before anyone was like even really paying attention to the whole Wuhan situation. Mm-hmm. Right. It's interesting that he would make that claim. And if you could read in the article, Barney Graham also had a lot of other interesting emails and exchanges with colleagues in the lead up to his first contact what would become the COVID-19 vaccine with Moderna CEO Stéphane Bancel. Basically, Barney Graham had also just the month before he said, get ready for a big 2020, had personally visited Moderna's facilities to discuss with them taking a vaccine he was co-developing with them to human trials. I think those trials still haven't even finished phase one. So it would be interesting if that's what they were really discussing. And he would make a trip to their facilities just for that, for a vaccine that was so far behind in its timeline and years probably away from being able to advance to human trials under normal circumstances. A lot of shady stuff there. And that's just the beginning of that. There's also the fact of we don't actually have the actual contents of those emails. They haven't been obtained by Freedom of Information Act request. Someone should do that. Mm-hmm. But we have the accounts of what those emails said and what transpired afterwards from Stéphane Bancel and Barney Graham. And they've been interviewed about those events by several mainstream media outlets over the past year and a half. And every time, details are different. What does that tell you? They don't have their story straight. I didn't note that expressly explicitly in the article, but it is something to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. And essentially, you know, Barney Graham, Stephen Bancel was allegedly troubled by the news out of China and asked Barney Graham, what do you think this is? And Barney Graham allegedly said, well, we don't know yet, but if it's a coronavirus, we're ready, in light of what he had been saying already in 2019. And this is before the sequence has even come out and anyone actually knows what type of virus it is. So that's very convenient. Per another account, he says, if it's a coronavirus, we're ready and we've proven mRNA to be effective. That claim that mRNA is proven to be effective is based off of data that what I believe was released by Moderna in September of 2019 for their CMV vaccine. But there's no way that positive data from a CMV vaccine would necessarily correlate to mRNA's efficacy in making a coronavirus vaccine. They're not even in the same family. CMV is the same family as chickenpox and herpes and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and shingles.
That stands out to me strongly. I mean, that's really, like, as you know, and you've covered as well. I mean, they were strongly failing, and no coronavirus vaccine before this had ever gotten even. The fact that he would state that says there's, like you're saying, there's something in there that we're not seeing. How are they ready for this when they failed repeatedly? Go ahead.
It gets even weirder. So there's the Barney Graham side and there's the Moderna side here. Essentially, after this conversation, even before the sequence is released and they know what it is, Barney Graham convinces the head of Moderna's vaccine program to just see how fast you can make a vaccine for this thing. Once the sequence comes out, you guys should start devoting resources. Remember, this is a company on the edge of collapse, supposedly, right?
Right.
You should start putting resources just to see how quickly, your accelerated vaccine stuff really is. Bet the farm on this thing that no one knows what the virus is or that we'll need a vaccine for it or any of this stuff. But why don't you do it? Wouldn't that be interesting? And they're like, yeah, let's do it. Even though their few remaining investors at the time all opposed this because they were like, we don't want you to invest in vaccines. We want you to invest in other mRNA therapies that are more lucrative and profitable, which if you read part one has always been a tricky issue for Moderna. The reason they even got in the vaccine business, and we can talk about this later in the context of the boosters, is that any multi-dose therapy Moderna tried to produce was too toxic to make it to human trials.
Exactly. And I'm glad you said that, because this is the big point that Senator, and I know you've covered this as well, around the lipid nanoparticles and the mRNA instructions, how every single time they could increase the lipid nanoparticles to make the instructions delivered and work effectively, it increased the side effects dramatically. I've never seen anybody point out why that is still not a problem, because how do they make it work? They increase the lipid nanoparticles.
Well, we can get to this later, but in the case of Moderna, they've claimed they're not using that delivery system that got them in trouble before. But as my article, this new article that's out, points out in great detail, there's no evidence for that. And actually, the evidence points in the other direction. And what's even crazier is that a lot of the safety studies that were done by the NIH on Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine, Moderna came out and said later, actually, they used the name of our commercial candidate in their study, mRNA-1273, for the convenience of readers. It's not actually the same as our commercial candidate. So allegedly, the NIH studies were being performed on a different vaccine than what was ultimately the one that Moderna took to market. That is astounding.
Let's focus on that for a second. That's so. Let's dive into that. So,
well, I don't. I want to get to that later, because I do think this beginning timeline is pretty important, just for showing how weird it is. So anyway, as I was saying earlier, basically Moderna was in this dire financial situation, and they're betting the farm on the musings of Barney Graham before the sequence is out. Wouldn't it be great to do this? Barney Graham and Moderna started working together, and Fauci was involved in this too, back in 2017. And 2017 is the year that Moderna was forced to make the pivot to vaccines because they couldn't have any multi-dose products. They knew they could never get them to market because of the issue that we just broached.
Pivot to therapies, you're saying, right?
Away from they pivoted away from therapies to anything multi-dose to vaccines. And the reason it was to vaccines is because that's one dose.
Oh, got it.
Per their definition of vaccines, right? They couldn't produce, they didn't think they were going to be able to produce anything after the failure of this particular therapy that year that was more than one dose. And so they're like, well, what can be one dose that's an mRNA therapy, a vaccine? And that's why that pivot was made. That same year is when Barney Graham and his team at the NIH develop a patent that's involved with, it's actually not just in use in the Moderna vaccine, it's in use by, I think, Pfizer, Novavax, Johnson & Johnson, CureVac, I mean, most of the COVID-19 vaccines on the market today. Mm-hmm. So Barney Graham, because of that, is making a payout. But before COVID, right, people have been trying to make a COVID or a coronavirus vaccine for any coronavirus, for as your viewers surely know, for a very long time, couldn't do that. You know, from SARS on, there were attempts made and they just couldn't get it to work. So Barney Graham's dream of using that patent, having that patent be commercialized, was essentially a pipe dream until COVID-19 happened. So he and his team are getting considerable royalties from that, though I do want to point out that federal law does cap how many royalties they can have since they're technically government researchers. But it's considerable. I mean, it's over six figures a year minimum. It's still a lot of money, and it's not just Moderna, it's all of this stuff. So it's interesting that there's this patent issue here with the case of Barney Graham, and he had apparently this great insight that it would be a coronavirus before anyone else knew, and that his patent would be used. And if you look at the patent filings by Barney Graham in 2017 and subsequent patents pre-COVID by NIH, even NYU law experts have had to note that it was very prescient, their views of the importance of those patents before there was any public reason to believe so. That's the Barney Graham side of it, essentially. With Moderna, it gets even weirder. Why are we betting, putting all these resources when we're cutting research everywhere else and we're putting this in this vaccine no one knows they need, and we don't even know what virus it is? We're just doing it for fun because Barney Graham called and said so. I mean, it's a really unbelievable story, and the fact that they think people swallow this narrative is like just beyond.
Had they failed in this regard, that would have been the end of them, correct?
Yeah, and they even admit that in this recent interview this week. If they had failed at any point, it would have been the end of Moderna as a company. Yeah. Wow.
Very, very revealing. So a lot of foreknowledge is quite obvious, or rather that they would be willing to roll the dice on something.
Just wait. this is before even the sequence of SARS-CoV-2 comes out, which was like January 11th. This is all before then. Right. Which is pretty significant if you remember back to January 20 and how the media situation was with respect to coronavirus or COVID-19.
It was ridiculous. But it is today.
January 21st, Stéphane Bancel goes to the Davos annual meeting, the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos, Switzerland. And that day, after spending all day with two unnamed disease researchers based in Europe, who knows who they could have been, he became convinced that day that it wouldn't be like SARS. It was going to be the 1918 flu pandemic all over again. And it was a biblical plague and all of this stuff. And they, in his accounts of it since, it's very dramatized and dramatic, but it's quite odd that he would get to Davos and immediately, you know, there a much darker vision of the future than anyone else foresaw. You know, and apparently there was, you know, he comes back and talks about making it, putting the COVID-19 vaccine project into overdrive and all of this stuff after being at Davos a day. And there's internal debate at the company because obviously the company is falling apart. So why are we betting the farm on this particular project that has no real prospects and our few remaining investors hate it? And apparently Bancel, for his thing, his account, thought it was absurd to even debate it because he was so convinced this is a biblical plague and there's no reason to not pursue it, essentially. Mm. It's odd.
Very odd.
Just odd.
Well, based on the timeline in general, I find this to be very, very interesting. And give me your thoughts on it. So based on that timeline, this is Moderna's page for those that haven't seen it, based, you know, their breakdown. And I always find interesting,
how
by the way, the
fast
videos
we
are.
Did it. Yeah.
Right. Well, so on January 11th, 2020, they say the Chinese authorities already shared the genetic sequence. By the way, Chinese CDCs admitted at that time they didn't isolate it. They just sent genetic sequence. But then by January 13th, they're already, like it says, NIH and Moderna's disease research team finalized the sequence. And they're already making injections by February 7th.
Yeah.
So give me your thoughts on the breakdown of the timing.
Okay, so they actually started the vaccine project on January 9th. This is according to them. And so all that was left to do was use the part, develop the part that required the sequence.
Wow.
And that's why it took those 2 days, right? Because they started developing it even before the sequence was out.
My God. This is just comically ridiculous. I mean, how are we supposed to expect that they would even know and know exactly what they would be working on before they even have the sequence? That's incredible.
Well, Ryan, the Washington Post told us it was a mix of serendipity and foresight.
That's what they say.
Yeah. And you know, Moderna's president was like, it was an awful lot of luck. Gee whiz. We're so, you know, lucky us. And isn't it weird that a couple years before they were saying the only thing that can save this company is a Hail Mary, a divine intervention, a miraculous set of circumstances that make all their problems magically disappear, of which there were many problems in different areas. COVID-19 resolved all of them.
Right, exactly. And save them. It's their miracle, as you put it. Exactly. The one thing. Well, it's interesting that it's noted mRNA-1273, as you pointed out before, and I want to make a comment on this. So we're talking February 24th. They've already actually shipped the first clinical batch. That's never changed, at least so we're told, right? And we can speak to your point about it being different, like they claimed.
Well, it was manufactured, I think, by the 14th or the 10th or something like that. Mm-hmm. Sorry, the 7th. There it is. Yeah. And then they right had here, to yeah wait for sterility tests and some other tests before they could send it to the NIH. Yeah.
Well, I'd like you to go in more on that one point. Before I do that, though, just remember for people out there that this is February 24th, 2020, or specific to her point, February 7th, 2020. It's done. So that has not changed, so we're told, based on the original strain, yet we're dealing with variants. And I want people to realize that that doesn't make sense. Robert Malone and plenty of others have pointed this out. James Lyons-Weiler, if you're dealing with a variant that's not currently present, at least the way they claim, like Delta is, for instance, this thing is not going to have the effect they're claiming it does. On top of that, it could actually create negatives if you're making antibodies for something that's not technically what you're dealing with. It's just staggering that this stuff is pushed out of the narrative by mainstream. But if you comment on that if you'd like, but I'd like you to dive into their claim this is different. That's really intriguing to me.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to screen share if that would be helpful, yeah, but I can also just read the quote itself. So basically what happened is, well, there's actually a couple different things to explain. So yeah, human trials for the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine, right, that begins like mid-March. There's a very controversial press release put out by Moderna in mid-May. I don't know if you remember, if any of you all remember the details of that specifically. But basically, it was the first preliminary release of positive data on the COVID-19 vaccine, created a huge explosion in Moderna stock that was already surging from February on, essentially. Yeah. And basically all of these Moderna executives, the top five especially, cashed out like $89 million in stock. And a lot of it's Boncel was a billionaire at that point. And the other executives became, millionaires or multimillionaires overnight. It was a pre-programmed stock sale. And so they released the press release that exact day when the stock sale was set up. It has very slimy optics. They've been attempting to explain it away for quite some time, saying, oh, it was to prevent a leak of the data more recently. They said it was necessary to keep them from collapsing and losing the COVID-19 race. It was a key part of their fundraising strategy at the time or something. They have
it looks like fleeing when you know that you've got it as high as you can before you know it's not going to work the way it's supposed to. My take. Go ahead.
Or maybe that's what they thought. I don't know. But basically, that's what happened. So it was very controversial. And also because the press release had very incomplete data. And even Fauci was mad that they put it out because the data was so incomplete and was widely criticized even by people in mainstream media that go along with the narrative and all of that, just from the scientific angle of the fact that they, released data on like 8 of the 40-something volunteers claiming it proved something. Where's the data on the other 37 or 32, whatever, I forget exactly how many volunteers in total that study was, but it's all in my report. Why didn't you release the full data on these people? Why are you, it was sort of the beginning of what's really just become established now, the science by press release thing. Right, oh, right. Pfizer says, yeah, okay, great. Pfizer said it, so it must be true. Moderna said it about their own product they want us to buy, so we should surely believe them. That's where we are. But this was, sort of the beginning of that trend that has now obviously been totally cemented in the case of the booster doses. Pfizer says it's effective. Moderna says it's effective in kids. Let's give it to kids. That's pretty much how it's been lately. Right.
It's amazing to see that from the mainstream media, just that it's they know people, even people that listen to them would walk away seeing that, like, you're just regurgitating what they've said. And that clip we play in the beginning is a perfect example of how that's really not even accurate. And there's a lot of ways they can manipulate that. And they've been proven to do so throughout history. But you know, if we need any more examples why the mainstream media is not on your side, come on, guys.
Yeah. But anyway, so that press release, that preliminary data, that's important for what I'm going to talk about next. That has to do with the issue you want to talk about. So in June and then later in July, there are two NIH studies that are published. The July study is the full results of that study touted by Moderna in May that I just mentioned, right, with the positive data. Okay. And specifically the one in July, heavily promoted on the TV by Fauci. There's no, you know, this is all good news any way you slice it. Fauci said something like that. And a lot of promotion for Moderna, another huge uptick in their stock. So basically, the issue I'm about to explain here is pretty complex. A lot of it has to do with patents regarding the lipid nanoparticle stuff. If my explanation now doesn't make a lot of sense to you, please go read the article and maybe it'll make more sense there, specifically part one, because I do start to outline the patent issues there. Because Moderna, for years, well before COVID, was locked in this very bitter patent dispute with a company called Arbutus Biopharma, okay? And this was one of the reasons that Moderna was facing collapse in 2019, in addition to their other issues. This patent issue and their failure to get a license for this technology they were relying on meant they were infringing on the patents of this company, and that that company could get royalties that would prevent them from ever making a profit on any product they ever took to market, essentially. Okay. So they claimed in 2019 to have gotten away from that, supposedly, for a couple reasons. And I go into more detail in it in the report. I don't want to get too in the weeds because it is very complicated. You know, patents, intellectual property, and all, right, and all this, the nitty gritty components of lipid nanoparticles and all of that. It is kind of woof for a lot of people. I can't really blame them. But essentially, Moderna tried to get away from the patent issue saying, oh, well, we're not using that system anymore. And they publicly called that system, Bancel did, of Moderna, not very good. Basically came up and said it's crap and it's not safe, because it was the same system that led them to abandon all multi-dose therapies, right?
Right.
So they claim their COVID-19 vaccine doesn't use that. But evidence in those June and July studies shows that, in fact, it does hinge on the or most likely hinges on the Arbutus patents. And that's because of if you read like the footnotes and stuff like that, they say that the lipid nanoparticles used in those studies relies on a ratio of different elements that's very specific. It's specific to the patent. And things like that. And so even mainstream outlets like Forbes went and were like, well, it looks like you are using the Arbutus patents, aren't you? Because also in July, Moderna lost a very important ruling in that patent dispute with Arbutus. So it did come to the attention of, I guess, the more diligent among the vaccine issue reporters and mainstream media. As far as I know, it was only covered by this one guy who used to write at Forbes, but doesn't anymore. I wonder why he doesn't anymore. Yeah. And then Stat News, which is a focus specifically on healthcare pharmaceutical issues. And so basically they go and they ask Moderna, so how do you explain this? They seem to be the same. And their chief corporate affairs officer at Moderna, Ray Jordan, says, while the NIH papers use the term mRNA-1273 or commercial candidate, it's not the same vaccine.
I can't believe that. I mean, how has this not been picked up on by any? I mean, this is the first time I'm even hearing about this.
Yeah, he says it. That's what he says. So I explain the implications of this and why Moderna probably said it, but it's very astounding they weren't called out on it. Right. I think a lot of it boils down to the Arbutus patent situation, because because they're trying to avoid a lawsuit from Arbutus. Not necessarily now, because the optics for Arbutus is bad. And even according to, you know, mainstream outlets like Stat News, that's why Arbutus hasn't gotten involved with suing Moderna recently. is to avoid bad optics and bad PR while the COVID-19 situation is viewed as urgent, but they're likely to do so down the line once that urgency and the potential for bad PR optics fade, yeah. Right? But in order for them to get away from that, I think that's really the only reason Ray Jordan would say that, because otherwise you're saying, right. Yeah, the stuff we used in our heavily touted safety studies, which factored into the emergency use authorization by the FDA, is not the same vaccine being injected into people. That's totally insane.
It is.
So it's either they're using the one that was unsafe for multi-dosing therapies from before, or it wasn't really even tested by the, I mean, it's just like either way you cut it is crazy.
Well,
which is it? Why haven't they been challenged on it since?
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying either we're using something that makes it illegal because they're violating a patent, they're using a patent they shouldn't be, or we're using something, as you said, that's not even the thing we said we tested. And as you pointed out, that directly calls into question the emergency authorization based on the results. They're claiming the results coming from a different product. This is a really big deal. And as you pointed out, I'm definitely going to dig into this more and talk about this. But this speaks to the same conversation we're having about like Pfizer, for instance, where there's at least questionable things in regards go ahead.
Well, Pfizer and BioNTech, that vaccine uses the same patents as Arbutus. They just have a license for it. Moderna, the way they licensed it was more messed up and pissed Arbutus off. And so they didn't recognize it because it was through a separate company that sort of had a sub license. And Moderna licensed it from them, I guess, because it was cheaper. This was allegedly done on the advice of Bob Langer. So he's technically the guy responsible because he's often described as a Moderna co-founder.
Yeah, good old Bob. He's always in there. Right?
Yeah. Well, he's technically the guy to blame for this whole mess that Moderna's in. But it's worth pointing out that those same patents are licensed and used in the Pfizer vaccine as well.
This is a really big, important find that I'm glad you're honing in on, because this is something that I believe there's much more going on around this topic than we are seeing. And I think you're kind of tapping into a thing that has already been skipped over by the mainstream media, by even other independent researchers. That's a really big deal. And right now it is already being approved in a lot of ways. And this is something that is very concerning to me. Go ahead.
Well, it opens up a very easy avenue for challenging Moderna in court. The fact that their chief corporate affairs officer said this. So it's either one thing or it's the other thing. If in fact he's lying, which I think would honestly be a better case situation for Moderna, and that it was the same vaccine as the NIH trials, and all of that, it means that it's relying on essentially the same technology that they had gotten prevented them from doing multi-dose therapies. That wipes out their justification, in my opinion, for a booster dose, which is already controversial. But if you're going to have it be an semi-annual dose, well, that's what the mRNA therapies they had hoped to pursue for being, because they were more lucrative. That is what they had wanted to pursue originally, but could not because it wasn't safe. So,
saying right, so it's either dangerous or it's
dangerous in the multi-dose thing, or it hasn't been tested and they engaged in clearly illegal activity to obtain the emergency use approval, and also in the May press release, because if it's not the commercial candidate and they know that, the executives that are cashing out and they're promoting this positive data that they know is not the same as the vaccine they want to take to market, I mean, this is nuts. This company is crazy. So the fact that we're taking anything they say at face value, or even the NIH, right? Why wouldn't the NIH be like, what do you mean it wasn't the commercial candidate? Like, why wouldn't they freak out at that?
Where's
we taking their word for anything? It's insane. And really a lot of another point here is that one of the only ways they could get emergency use authorization is by having criteria applied to their vaccine product as the same criteria applied to traditional vaccines, not to mRNA vaccines, because that allows them to skip over the whole lipid nanoparticle issue, because obviously that's not a factor in traditional vaccines and it's not part of the criteria for their approval. So by treating them as traditional vaccines when they're really based on a novel technology was really the only way to get, you know, Pfizer and Moderna approved in the span of weeks that that approval did take place. All of this, again, justified by the urgency of the crisis. And, you know, if it had gone back to the lipid nanoparticle situation, Moderna, I don't think would have been able to have get it approved because they couldn't previously in the regulatory environment that existed before COVID-19. But COVID-19 has changed all of that. And if you read part one, and I'm sure you've shown it on your show as well, mm-hmm. This panel where Fauci speaks at the Milken Institute with Rick Bright of BARDA. And, you know, Fauci's there talking about they need a disruptive event to sort of force, modernize vaccine development to be, to include mRNA and all of this stuff, how they needed a disruptive event. And they needed people to be scared of the flu and all of this stuff that ended up essentially happening over the course of the past year and a half ended up coming to pass. And, you know, that's not, there's also the fact that, you know, Event 201, right? The World Economic Forum and Gates Foundation are very much partnered with Moderna. Moderna has been working in close partnership with them since 2013, a strategic ally of the Gates Foundation since 2016, all working to this end. And Event 201 simulates, a coronavirus spreading around the world that's highly transmissible and a flu-like illness, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just...
The level of foreknowledge that's displayed when you really stand back and look at the process is just unbelievable. I mean, what you described already in conjunction with 201 and how self-serving it was to make it a coronavirus and make it, it's baffling. And it just,
even that, but how can Bansell, when he's so closely tied to the organizations that did Event 201, be so surprised like 3 months later when an analogous scenario appears? Like he wouldn't have been aware of that. Yeah. Especially considering that one of the main recommendations of Event 201 was promoting and investing in novel vaccine technology, right. Like mRNA.
That's one of my favorite points about Event 201, how silly it is. It's like, so why do they even have these programs if they're going to not even do all the things they say we need to do after they're done? Every single time they do that, we should get more PPE, we should do this. And they're like, why didn't we have more PPE? And it's just so silly. It's my predictive programming, as I'm sure you probably agree. They're setting it in the mind. And it's obvious.
It's more for that than anything else. And it's for getting the narrative straight. That's why you have to look at what the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security did with Dark Winter before the anthrax attacks. It was all about having the right narrative of who's to blame, how to manage disinformation and all of that stuff. And that's really what Event 201 was, I think, personally focusing on. That's why they had one of the main guys from Edelman PR, one of the biggest PR firms in the world, be like a main participant. Because, you know, that's sort of the direction they were heading in. And then Avril Haine, who's like, you know, ex number two at the CIA, and that's all normal. And they're run by the people that did Dark Winter.
Chinese CDC presence, right? It's not a coincidence. That was all just the little gang powwow of exactly what seemed to, I mean, quite literally.
Well, don't forget either the guy who participated in Dark Winter, that the name of Dark Winter comes from, Robert Padlick, right? He did Crimson Contagion in 2019. Which is about a pandemic influenza that comes from China specifically and spreads all over the world through air travel. And that went on for most of 2019. That wasn't just one event. That was from January to August of 2019. And actually had a lot of, as I point out in part one, a lot of coincidences with Moderna. For example, the specific influenza strain named in Crimson Contagion was being co-developed with BARDA that Robert Kadlec was overseeing at the time Crimson Contagion was taking place. And then, of course, BARDA is the... after CEPI the main financer of Moderna's COVID vaccine. I think that was in April of 2020. And since then, $6 billion of U.S. taxpayer money has gone to the Moderna vaccine. And that's supposedly for early access to the Moderna vaccine. And that will probably continue.
Oh,
absolutely.
This is
insane. So the evidence just in these two pieces of criminality on the part of Moderna, I think, is really obvious. I think it needs to be looked at pretty closely. I mean, this is a company that was essentially going the way of Theranos that got it saved, whereas Theranos didn't. But if you remember back to Theranos, I mean, they had people like Henry Kissinger on the board and people who didn't belong there, investors that didn't belong there. Moderna has some similar things like that to it as well. Especially now. I mean, it's a...
Do you think that Theranos maybe was the first try and it didn't succeed? I mean, that wasn't that long
ago. I think it was an attempt. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Because obviously the people that were backing it, I mean, the narrative, it's sort of like what they did with Epstein, where they're like, oh, well, now Epstein's gone. So the whole situation's saved. And it's not like he had a network behind him that enabled his activity. You know, it was just him being a charming, charismatic, creepy pedo, whatever. And it was just him, no one else. Okay. Right. And so Elizabeth Holmes, you know, it was sort of like, well, oh, this was all her idea and she's the bad one and blah, blah, blah. It's not like she had a network of enablers behind her and powerful people. How did she get Kissinger on the board of her company, the Stanford dropout? you know,
well,
I mean, that's the narrative they like to sell because then they can like make an example of that one fall guy and then it's over. But if Moderna had failed, I think it would have been like, you know, how many companies in this biotech space at this fusion of healthcare and Silicon Valley, where those two fields sort of meet, how many of them are like Theranos?
Right, right. You can't have a picking
probably a lot of them.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so since I'm not sure how much time you have today, so why don't we finish with one point here that I think is interesting that I want to ask you about. That same vein of discussion, right? I clearly see Dr. Fauci right now being thrown under the bus. Now, whether or not that kind of recovers or not, which we've seen happen before, on that vein of thought, what are your thoughts on that? And do you kind of feel that he might be the next person to be, it was just Fauci.
I don't know if they can do that with Fauci though, because he's been in that same position since the 80s, doing the same shit he's doing now since the 80s.
So it's like pulling the rug out. They can't really do that.
So he might have been there too long, you know?
It would be a good scapegoat to be him.
It would definitely satisfy some of the anger among the American public right now, maybe to an extent. Yeah. But I mean, we also sort of saw a fall from grace a little bit of Bill Gates, right? But how far did that really go with the Epstein stuff?
Good point. You know? And even during COVID, he kind of disappeared for a minute. Now he's back. You know, it's like
now he's back with climate change. He's back with a new thing, right? But he's a billionaire philanthropist. He's not, you know, a guy that's been in the same position of the health bureaucracy shilling for big pharma for 40 years. I mean, Fauci has a much more specific niche than Bill Gates does, right? Yeah. So I think that may complicate it because if it's like, wow, if Fauci's so bad, what has been going on there at that place he leads for the past 40 years?
Yeah.
I don't think they want that kind of scrutiny on on the NIH, especially on gain of function stuff, right? Yeah. Because it's not like this gain of function research is exclusive to the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Exactly. Right?
If you have scrutiny of that, you're going to have scrutiny of all the non-Lugar centers all over surrounding like Russia and China, where the U.S. conducts a bunch of very shady gain of function experiments. The stuff with the dogs in Tunisia, that's really just scratching the surface of what the NIH has been funding, especially in the name of pandemic preparedness, right? I sort of go into this a little bit with my anthrax research of what happened. After the fact, right? But it's and you know, you also have like I read about this last year for T Lab. There's at UPMC in Pittsburgh, allegedly to create a vaccine, they're combining SARS-CoV-2 based on its genetic sequence with anthrax. Why would you do that?
You're kidding me.
Why would you do that? You know,
it's self-serving is why I think that's
where's the coverage of that in terms of gain of function stuff. I mean, that thing gets out, that could be crazy. Wow. I mean, that's just insane. You know, because one of the main justifications for gain of function research this whole time has been vaccine development. If you ask the head of like the Center for Vaccine Research at UPMC, he's a big gain of function advocate. And he's like, well, it's either to learn interesting biology or vaccine development. So it's intimately related to the vaccine industry, and they're not going to want to give up their role in financing and conducting that type of research. So I don't really think they can throw Fauci that much under the bus. Maybe a slap on the wrist for the Wuhan stuff, but they can't go that deep. Mm-mm.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, I think it's interesting to watch how these things go, and it does feel like there's enough pushback to maybe cause an extreme reaction, but we'll see what happens. Last point. Did you see the fact that the NIH just got caught essentially altering their definition of some of the things? Just thoughts on that as we wrap up here. I think that's exactly what you're talking about. They're trying to hide it when they point back and be like, we didn't do gain of function.
But they've been doing this like the past year and a half, manipulating definitions. They've even changed the definition of what a vaccine is in order to get around a lot of the issues that have come up. So why wouldn't they change the definition of gain of function?
Right.
Exactly. To fit it. I mean, they got away with changing the definition of vaccine.
And herd immunity.
I don't even really know what to call it. I want to say it's just like fucking with us, but it's obviously going to level beyond that.
Sinister, malvoyant.
Changing the definition of words so that when you go to debate and use long established definitions of words, they can be like, aha, we have changed the definition of the word you are using. So now you think you're saying one thing, but really you're saying another. We're so smart.
I think you and I have even had a conversation about this. We've talked like back in foreign policy time where it was, regime change is now a good thing. these things don't exist. So when we say regime change, people are thinking, oh, you mean for freedom? It's like, no, that's not what that actually means. You're right. I think that's what we're seeing right now in an aggressive way. And that's the technocratic future.
Go ahead. Also, this definition stuff is important in the context of booster doses, because what you're doing, like we talked about earlier with Chile, you're changing the definition of what vaccinated means, what fully vaccinated means in the context of the COVID-19 crisis. So how do you create a pandemic of the unvaccinated where none exists? You start defining people with two doses of the vaccine as unvaccinated, and you create a new class of three dose people, and only they are considered fully vaccinated. So you're moving the goalposts, and then you can create your pandemic of the unvaccinated by changing the definition of what unvaccinated means.
Exactly. That's a great place to leave it right there. That is your future, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't stand up and do something about it. Thank you for being here, Whitney. Your research is outstanding, as always. I'm definitely going to dig into that article, probably talk about that point you suggest. And anything you want to leave us with before we wrap up today?
Don't let the U.S. become what Chile is becoming. That's for sure. I don't want to say it's a bleak, because I do have some hope, but basically my hope is based on me going and living in the middle of nowhere, which is actually quite easy and cheap to do here. I definitely couldn't afford to buy land in a place like the U.S. or the U.K., but I can here, right? So, maybe that'll end up being a blessing. But I mean, because I talk about this stuff, I do get some people being like, oh, I'm worried about you and whatever. I mean, like, I'll be fine. The important thing here is like in any time we're facing situations like this, I mean, the situation in Chile right now is going to come to other countries if it's not there yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to try and do it soon. Right. So the important thing is to know that you make the decision not to comply, even when everyone around you is complying. That's an important step, and to know what you're going to do in that situation, and to prepare for that in advance, really, and to keep it from advancing to the point where it's gotten to in some other countries while you can, or at the very least in your local community, because the U.S., you're not really going to have much sway over the federal government, but local government is a little more likely.
I couldn't agree more, right? I mean, like as Corbett says, this will stop when we stop it. When we decide
right.
to stand up and push back. And as Whitney's pointing out, personally, you can't be too prepared. It's always smart to be prepared. And it's that this whole thing has shown you that, if nothing else, we should have been, having water and food and different things is always the smart way to go. So thank you so much for being here, Whitney. I think that was a great discussion and some dangerous thoughts out there that we need to keep poking at. So as always, question everything, come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.